we have an opportunity to get two views on conditions. And so you're going to get two views today because I want to tell you a story. And this is a story about the secret of the universe. You know, when I was studying Chinese medicine during the years that I was living in Boulder, Colorado, my teacher, Dr. Mingying Zhao, had emigrated from Shanghai. She is an MD and a sixth-generation acupuncturist. And so in China, just as it is here in the United States, the licensure for MD and the licensure for acupuncture are separate licenses. So even though a lot of people think of acupuncture when they think of China, not all doctors do acupuncture in China even. But Dr. Ming, because of her family history, was very much an acupuncture-minded MD. And when she emigrated to the United States because of the language issues, she did not relicense as an MD, but she licensed as an acupuncturist. And she taught me Chinese medicine. She taught me pulse diagnosis and tongue diagnosis and a Chinese perspective of the way to look at the body. And one of the things that she told me was a cute little story, but it's a story that means a lot. She said when two old men greet each other in the street in China, they don't say, "Hey, how you doing, buddy? What's going on?" What they say is "How's your middle burner?" How is your middle burner? So the nature of how is your middle burner means how is your digestion working? In Chinese medicine, the upper burner is your lung fire or your respiratory fire. Your middle burner is your digestive fire, and your lower burner is your reproductive fire. So when one old bird says to the other, "How's your middle burner?" what they're actually asking is, how are you digesting your food? And so the saddest thing that one guy can say to another is, "My fireplace has gone cold." And so "my fireplace has gone cold" means I'm not digesting my food anymore. Well, if you're not digesting your food anymore, you're not going to live. So, doctor, today I'd like to talk about what happens when your fireplace goes cold.
That sounds like a good idea. I think where you're leading us is into this very, very complex world of our what some of us actually refer to as the second brain. Issues that we're dealing with here are related to the gut. The gut is where it's the interface with our interface with the outside world. So
yes, it's where the outside meets the inside.
Yeah. So if we have difficulty there, we're going to have difficulty dealing with our world and not living in it very much longer.
Well, and the thing about it is, you know, in Chinese medicine, they talk about digestion separating the clean from the unclean. And separating the clean from the unclean means we take the food and we break it down and we get rid of the part that doesn't serve us. And then the clean becomes our vitality. It becomes our chi. It becomes our energy. Because, you know, stop and think about it. You had breakfast, I presume, by now. And so maybe you had a bowl of cereal. Maybe you had a toasted bagel. Maybe you had some eggs. But there isn't any part of your body that looks like a scrambled egg. There isn't any part of your body that looks like a piece of toast. Those foods go in your mouth. We masticate or chew them up and mix them with the enzyme ptyalin that we secrete out of our salivary glands. And then that food transports those 9 inches down the esophagus into the stomach. And that stomach is divided into two sections, the fundus at the top of the stomach where all the food goes in, and the antrum or the bottom of the stomach where everything gets mushmollied around and turned into this milky material called chyme. And that's spelled C-H-Y-M-E. And for those of you that are Scrabble players, you know that the reason I was able to play killer Scrabble when I was living in Colorado is because I knew all these digestion names. I have won a great Scrabble game with the word tile, the enzyme that's in your mouth, and I've won a great Scrabble game with the word chyme.
Yes.
So this material then leaves your stomach and goes into your small intestine, but only after it's been mixed up with stomach acid, hydrochloric acid, which breaks into pepsin. And these enzymes end up helping to digest your proteins. That's really all they work on is proteins. And then that chyme goes into your small intestine and your pancreas secretes a whole load of enzymes, proteases to digest protein, lipases to digest fat, and amylases to digest starches. So this is a really incredibly complex pathway, because then after the pancreas squirts in that payload of enzymes, the food is still going to take 10 hours to travel 20 feet through that small bowel, a tube about an inch in diameter. And that's where 90% of your digestion is taking place and the absorption of your nutrients are taking place. And finally, after they're digested and after they're absorbed, then the material goes to the large intestine, where the fluids are recycled, the water is taken out of that material and recycled in the body, and ultimately we get a payoff in terms of the waste products going out the exit door. And so that's just a little tour of the gastrointestinal system. And
it really is a system. There's so much involved. You have the nervous system communicating with the gut and the gut communicating with the nervous system back and forth to have the stomach motility occur and smush things around, to have the acid released, to have the enzymes then released from the pancreas, to have the small intestinal motility occur. And then you also have the immune system communicating with the nervous system and the gut, because the immune system's down there surveying all the things that are coming through. And the immune system can also trigger increase or decrease in the motility, increase or decrease in secretions directly or through communicating with the nervous system. And so there, and then we have the internal milieu with all the bugs, the bacteria, the beneficial bacteria, and sometimes imbalanced bacteria that can interfere with the usual communication that bacteria have with your gut lining, with the immune system, with the nervous system. So you have at least four different separate areas of interaction that all communicate with each other: the gut wall itself, the nervous system, the immune system, and the milieu inside.
And so when we look at this digestive system, if in fact your middle burner is working, if in fact you're digesting your food well, then your body's going to have the nutrients that it needs to do functions. But sometimes, and especially if you watch television, you would believe that every other person on the planet has excess stomach acid. And you've heard me say before here on No Nonsense Nutrition that what I see in my practice is way more people who don't have enough stomach acid. I probably don't see but maybe two people out of an entire calendar year that actually are hyper or too much acid. The majority of people that I see are hypo or too little acid. But the irony is that the symptoms are identical: heartburn, reflux, what we've titled gastroesophageal reflux disease, or GERD.
Yes. GERD appears to be the American malady. However, it's not a malady of genetics or a malady of personal inability to make acid or to make too much acid. It's actually more likely a malady of lifestyle.
And so we see individuals and they don't make enough stomach acid, and then they get heartburn, and then they go to their... Well, first off, they start out with some little tablet. They take a Tums, they take a Rolaid, they take an Alka-Seltzer, a Pepcid, an Axid, something over the counter, some Pepto-Bismol, some Maalox, something to solve their stomach blues. And then after a period of time, they find out that those remedies don't work, so they go to the doctor and they get...
A proton pump inhibitor or an H2 blocker, some kind of medication to stop the stomach acid production.
And so when we look on these proton pump inhibitors, you've heard me talk on many different occasions about how dangerous these products are when they're used over a long period of time, because these proton pump inhibitors stop the production of stomach acid. And there is one very important use of those proton pump inhibitors, and that is to stop the production of stomach acid when somebody really has an ulcer that's been described as a result of sticking a tube down your esophagus and looking at the lining of the stomach and actually determining that an ulcer is there. So there is an appropriate use for a proton pump inhibitor.
that is the appropriate use for the proton pump inhibitor. I disagree with the FDA's indication. They've actually allowed and given official permission to for the drug companies to advertise their proton pump inhibitors for this disorder called GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disease. GERD is a functional disorder, though. GERD is not a syndrome caused by excessive production of stomach acid. It's caused by a variety of things, but you get symptoms potentially of acid in your chest, which is heartburn. You reflux or slightly regurgitate some acid, but that doesn't mean you make too much acid. That means you're not actually moving the acid down quickly enough to get it out of your stomach to put it where it's supposed to be, into your small intestine, to trigger the pancreas to release bicarb to neutralize the acid. It's a complex process, again, that involves many organs and many different signaling.
So I go back to Chinese medicine, because Chinese medicine really does give a more accurate title for that condition. Heartburn in Chinese medicine is called rebellious fire blazing upward.
And
rebellious fire blazing upward sounds like a much more accurate description than heartburn, because it doesn't have anything to do with the heart.
Right.
But what's true is it happens in the area of the heart. But one of the things that I'm seeing, doctor, in my practice are a number of people who have been put on these proton pump inhibitors and then very soon afterward are diagnosed with something that I never heard of 5 years ago, which was gastroparesis.
Yes.
Gastro, obviously, involving the digestion, and paresis meaning weak or paralyzed. And so when we talk about gastroparesis, what we're talking about is the stomach no longer moves the food downstream.
Right. It's a chronic condition that is associated with nausea and bloating after meals, sometimes vomiting, stomach fullness, inability to eat a whole meal, simply because the stomach is just not willing to accept it, because it's backed up. It's got stuff residual in it, usually hours after your previous meal.
And so when I ate my fruit this morning, I had fruit and yogurt, as you often hear me say on Monday morning, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, fruit and yogurt breakfast. And so I had my papaya and mango and, ooh, some champagne grapes today and a few strawberries in there. And that food isn't going to spend very much time in the stomach at all. In fact, fruit, if it's up at room temperature at the point that you eat it, will hardly stay in the stomach for 30 minutes. But when you eat flush protein, you had a piece of steak, you had a piece of chicken, you had a piece of salmon, any of those flush proteins are likely to stay in your stomach on average 4 hours, but not uncommonly up to 6 hours before they empty and go into your small bowel. And so when we look at that digestion time, when we're talking about gastroparesis, we're talking about individuals who could still have those contents that would normally empty in 4 hours in their stomach 12 and 16 hours later.
Right. That's when you fill a stomach to capacity. You could eliminate, you know, an ounce of, like, an egg or something like that, even though it is protein. That would go out relatively quickly. The study that they do for looking at gastroparesis is a gastric emptying study. They actually administer a stable radioisotope labeled, in other words, a radioactive food, solid
Yum.
Food, yeah, that they can actually watch the transit of the radioactivity through your stomach. And the ballpark is approximately greater than 50% should be gone by 90 minutes. That's kind of their benchmark.
And so when we begin to look at this condition called gastroparesis, what I've seen is that it's shown up in my practice repeatedly in the last few years, most often with diabetics, but very frequently in the nature of my practice over the last couple of years. Gastroparesis has been diagnosed, and people get this stomach motility test or this gastric emptying time test, and then they're told that they need to be on a drug.
Right.
Well, oftentimes these people have already been put on one drug, which is a proton pump inhibitor, slowing down their body's production of stomach acid. So now we've got a stomach that's already not emptying very well, and we stop the very enzymes that are necessary for it to empty well.
Right. because you really do need to have the acid there to trigger the more motility that will trigger the emptying and trigger the rest of the digestive process.
You know, we keep talking about motility, and what we don't realize is that everything in your digestive system wiggles like a worm. Your stomach actually crushes and grinds and squeezes and mashes and breaks up food mechanically as well as chemically. And then as we look at that 20 to 25 feet of small and large intestine, that peristalsis, or that wiggling action of the muscles that moves the food ever further downward, that is what we're talking about when we're talking about motility, the ability of the muscular part of the digestive system to move the food downward only.
Right. When you get this paresis, it tends to move upwards a little bit because as you add more food to it, you have less space to put it, so it's going to regurgitate back up through the lower esophageal sphincter, the divider at the top of the stomach that keeps things in the stomach. That will get lax with time as you stretch and stretch the stomach. I think there are several things that happen when people develop gastroparesis. Part of it could be mechanical. I think that many people overeat. If you stretch the lining of the stomach repeatedly, you're going to make it less interested in trying to force things down.
So that's one of the reasons that I see gastroparesis happen more in bulimics, people
yes.
that have had a bulimic history. Bulimics are really the only people that actually have a larger than normal stomach, usually.
Because they force it. They stretch it, and then they purge it.
Right.
And then, in addition to that, as you stretch and fill the stomach with so much food, you actually overwhelm its capacity to make acid. Or actually, you overwhelm its ability to keep up with the amount of food. It's still making the same amount of acid for a while, I believe. But I think that after you've abused it for years with overeating, it eventually loses some of its capacity. You burn out the cell's ability to keep up with it. And these are the people that eventually develop some hypochlorhydria, or low stomach acid.
So when we look on TV and we see the hot dog eating contest, the pie eating contest, the whatever eating contest, we can pretty well pick out of the crowd individuals who might end up with gastroparesis 10 years hence.
And diabetes.
Yeah. So, absolutely.
And one of the reasons that diabetes is so implicated in this is that diabetes actually kills nerves. And so as many as 30% of diabetics have gastroparesis, and it's because they have neuropathy, nerves that have been damaged. So the communication doesn't occur well, so that you don't get the signals to the wall of the stomach to make it move.
And so this really is the definition of gastroparesis, is that the stomach becomes paralyzed or unable to move, and we have a situation where the nerves in the stomach actually are damaged. But I have to tell you, doctor, a number of the people that I've seen in my practice that have gastroparesis, as soon as we put them on supplemental enzymes, they improve.
Oh, I agree. I think that the current Western medical approach, and I've done a bunch of reading on it, is very, very, very limited, as you and I would agree on many subjects that Western medicine
right.
approaches. The problem is they've boiled it down to, one issue, and that is just the motility issue. They really don't look at the global problem of nervous system, inflammation, immune system, intact intestinal integrity, and the intestinal milieu. They don't look at these separate components. We know that gastroparesis can cause something called SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. That is a change in the normal flora of your gut. When you get that, it will actually itself induce motility changes. It will slow down gut motility. It will also cause increased inflammation, which will, again, cause decreased motility, which the inflammation can then cause nervous damage, which will then cause decreased motility. If we can fix some of the functional physiologic problems from a multifactorial standpoint and go at it with looking at the nervous system and the inflammation and the gut milieu, we can actually get some progress and fix this without having to look at it as here's a medicine to fix this one problem. And actually, they're finding out that the medicines aren't even working that well after a time, and they're looking at now gastric stimulators, implanting electrodes lining the gut to make it pump.
Yikes.
because they're looking at it simply as a mechanical issue.
Okay, so let's go back to this thing called SIBO, small intestine bacterial overgrowth. SIBO will be distinguished, number one, by bloat very soon after eating. And so these are individuals that are going to wake up in the morning and their belly is nice and flat, and then they eat something sweet at breakfast. They have a piece of fruit, or they have a glass of juice, or they put jelly on their toast, or they have a sweet roll. Maybe all they have is just their toasted bagel. And what happens is over the next 40 minutes or an hour, they start to bloat. And with each succeeding meal through the day, the bloat gets worse. Now, they're not necessarily gassy, but they are definitely bloaty. And so that's one of the first things that we're going to see with small intestine bacterial overgrowth is this amount of bloat. When people have an overgrowth of yeast, they not only bloat, but they're also gassy.
Right.
And so that's one of the distinguishing characteristics between small intestine bacterial overgrowth. Now, how do you get small intestine bacterial overgrowth? Most often in my practice, I see it as a result of three different things. Number one, abuse of alcohol. Number two, abuse of sweets. And number three, series of antibiotics where people have had a dental procedure. I have a client right now. Had a dental procedure, was on antibiotics for 2 weeks, went back and did another dental procedure, was on antibiotics for another week, went back and had to fix what didn't get done in the first two times, and was on antibiotics a fourth week. So 4 out of 8 weeks she took antibiotics and ended up with SIBO.
Right. That's quite a common occurrence. The disruption,
unfortunately,
yeah, this disruption in the gut flora is not addressed with Western medicine. It's so easy to do, and we have evidence that the good probiotics that we use actually are resistant to some of the more common antibiotics like penicillin. So if you give it concurrently, you're actually reinforcing the gut while you're trying to basically tear it down with those antibiotics. So you may actually prevent SIBO if there was some more thought behind a global approach to the patient while you're treating one specific thing. Look at the whole issue and help it balance the body rather than just attacking.
Well, the thing that surprised me is that when I had clients come into my practice who'd already been diagnosed with gastroparesis, very many of them were on a drug that the FDA has not been approved to use in the United States, a drug called domperidone.
Right.
And so because of the fact that this drug, which is a wonderful drug for use if somebody has terrible vomiting, somebody gets a bad flu, or they get a reaction to a pharmaceutical drug, or they get a reaction to an anesthesia. You know, this is a terrific drug to help to stop that response. But first off, it's not available in the United States. So these clients are coming in and saying, well, I have to get this drug from Canada, or I have to get this drug from Europe because I can't get it in the United States. And so even though the FDA's own digestive committee approved it, the FDA as a whole did not approve it. But that, in connection with a second drug, really those two drugs are the only drugs that I know of that are being used to treat gastroparesis. And when I look at a drug like Reglan, I have to be very concerned about people having facial tics or uncontrolled muscle movements that come as a result of the use of a drug like Reglan.
Right. Reglan is very potent. It has a lot of central nervous system side effects. The people that tolerate it actually get some pretty good success with it. Domperidone has much less side effects, but it does have some hormonal activities, and occasionally it can cause a swelling of the breast and some tenderness there. But generally, it's very well tolerated. And unfortunately, it is very expensive and must be attained outside the country, because the FDA has not yet approved it. The other drugs that we used to have to use for this problem were so toxic that they were removed from the market. The other prokinetic agents were just, they were deadly.
Well, I mean, tardive dyskinesia is pretty scary to me. If you've ever seen, oftentimes a very senior member of our society have tongue thrusting or twitching in the face, These things can be initiated by this drug. It can be initiated by other drugs as well. But fundamentally, because it works on the dopamine receptors, dopamine is the neurotransmitter that you've heard of that is involved in Parkinson's disease.
Right.
And so when we lose dopamine, we lose muscle coordination. And this is what we see in the Parkinsonian client who has ratcheting movements and a shuffling gait. And so this tardive dyskinesia that can happen as a result of the, in this case, not affecting the production of the dopamine, but affecting the receptor sites that use dopamine. And so as a result, the muscle contractions can occur in an involuntary way. And the problem that happens is people have gone off this drug, Reglan, and yet maintained these involuntary muscle spasms.
Yes, and that's a rarity, but it really is a serious complication because the nervous system doesn't recover from the insult in some rare instances. One of my first years in practice, I watched a man essentially levitate off of his hospital bed after we gave him Reglan. He had, I believe the word is opisthotonus. His entire body went into kind of a muscle spasm, and he kind of arched up off the bed, and he didn't come down until we loaded him up with enough Valium to sedate a large horse. And he, needless to say, never got Reglan again.
Yeah, yikes. So here we've got this condition, gastroparesis, that's getting diagnosed more and more frequently. We've only got two drugs that are being used for it, both of which have potential toxic side effects. And so right away, I'm going to look to number one, getting rid of the proton pump inhibitor.
Right. And in fact, it's funny, that's one of the ancillary medications used to treat gastroparesis symptoms because of the reflux of the small amount of acid that's left. That's a second-line therapy, proton pump inhibitors, which is going to make the problem worse.
Well, and the first thing that I will generally do is put somebody on both pancreatic enzymes and on gastric support. You know, there are two families of digestive enzymes. One family are the pancreatic enzymes or the pancreatic phase enzymes, and these are enzymes that are ideally taken prior to a meal.
Right.
You want to put them in the belly so that they're sitting there waiting for the food to show up. But when we try to do something to enhance the gastric phase or the stomach phase of digestion, when we're adding in betaine hydrochloride or other support nutrients that help increase the amount of stomach acid, those things are always used, ideally always used, after a meal. You wouldn't want to put that in the stomach at the beginning of the meal because you want the stomach to produce all the acid that it's going to produce and then add to the mix.
Give it a little kick at the end.
But, you know, what's interesting to me, I had a client in practice just this last week, and she said she was waking up with a little bit of a sore throat that would go away as the day went on. And I said, well, you know, if you get a sore throat and it's bacterial or viral, it will worsen.
Right.
You'll have it, and then, you know, 6 hours later it's worse, and 12 hours later it's worse. And she says, no, I'm waking up with it, but it's going away. And I also have this little cough in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And we called it a kitty cat cough. Just this little going on. And I turned to her and I said, has your husband ever said anything to you about your breath? And she said, oh, yeah, my husband has said something to me about my breath. Well, you put those three things together, a little bit of sore throat, a little bit of cough, and bad breath, and I got news for you. We're headed toward gastroparesis.
That's
that
right.
That is a hypoacidic stomach. And immediately I put her on digestive enzymes. This is a woman that I can expect will go directly down the route of gastroparesis. What other recommendations do you have, doctor?
Well, like you said, it's time to get off the proton pump inhibitors. I think the FDA did a great disservice to the country by letting Prilosec go OTC. People can go and buy the purple pill when they feel that they just have that need to abuse their body with a pizza and a beer.
Did you see the new ad?
Oh,
I saw the new ad on the TV last night. It's got the guy where it shows that his clothes are on fire. He's got these little burning places. And he's trying to figure out whether he should take the proton pump inhibitor before the meal, after the meal, before the pizza, after the pizza. like that.
Uh-huh.
So, and then about 5 minutes, this was on the news last night, the 6:30 news, world
right.
news. And so about 5 minutes later, they had a break, and they had another proton pump inhibitor on there. And essentially, and then it didn't have real people on it. It had, you know, the little caricature people
yes.
on there. And it said, you can eat whatever you want as long as you take this pill.
It's fabulous.
So the person could continue to eat the junk that they had no business eating. I mean, stop right here. I heard a comic one time on television, and the comic was talking about the fact that he was watching the Super Bowl, and that every other ad on the Super Bowl was for some sort of digestive disturbance. You know, there was gas remedies, there was constipation remedies, there was stomach acid remedies, there was bloating remedies, there were diarrhea remedies, just one right after the other in the Super Bowl. And the comic screamed into the microphone, "It's the food!"
Yeah, really. For 2 weeks up to the Super Bowl, they advertise all that junk for you to buy for your party.
Right. Let's mix the salsa and the plastic cheese so we can dip the fried corn chips into it.
But don't forget, let's microwave it in the plastic container so we can have phthalates on the side.
Yeah, right. And wash it down with a good diet beer. So what we're seeing when we see these advertisements is people who believe that they could just continue to break rules. You know, how many rules can you break and still make it to age 70?
Well, this is the American attitude. I mean, look, we just decided as a country we're going to, who cares? We'll default on our massive public debt. What's it matter? Let's break the rules.
Uh-huh.
What is this attitude that we can get away with this? Why is it that we have this entitlement attitude that the rules don't apply to us?
Well, I have to remember that commercial from my youth, you can't fool Mother Nature.
That's
and
for sure.
And this is the situation here with these stomachs, is we can't fool Mother Nature. We need to bracket a digestion that isn't working with using pancreatic enzymes before the meal and acid supporters after the meal. Now, let's look at folklore and see what folklore tells us. If you've ever bought bitters to make a Manhattan, those Angostura bitters or any other company's bitters, those are a plant known as green gentian, gentiana. And actually, we have gentian that grows right out on Siesta Key Beach. I saw some of it yesterday. And so if you take a bottle of bitters and you shake three or four shakes into just a little snort of water, like an ounce of water, and drink that about 15 or 20 minutes before you eat, that will help you make more stomach acid. That's one of the easy folklore remedies. There are some people who
take... So I have a question. Can you use the ones that they use in the on the mixing bar, Angostura bitters?
Yeah.
That's it.
That's okay. Green gentian. The other one is some individuals claim that apple cider vinegar cures almost everything. Well, apple cider vinegar doesn't cure as many things as people would like to think, but it will increase the acidity of the stomach.
This is true.
So for somebody to take a tablespoon of apple cider vinegar at the end of their meal, they will lower the pH of their stomach and enhance digestion as a result.
Right.
The use of ginger tea. If you take fresh ginger root and you cut about 4 coins of ginger, about the thickness of a nickel, like when I'm talking about cutting coins, I'm talking about just like you would cut a carrot into coins. You cut a ginger root into coins, put it in 2 cups of water, boil the heck out of it for 20 minutes, and then drink that cup of ginger tea. That will also enhance digestion. So there are a number of things, from apple cider vinegar to ginger tea to green gentian or bitters, that we can use to enhance digestion. They're all very inexpensive ways that we can try to enhance digestion. But I'm telling you, if we've got an absolute diagnosis of gastroparesis, those things are not going to solve the problem.
Well, there is some evidence in the article I just gave you, actually, that ginger in gastroparesis may help. Ginger extract, I think 1,200 milligrams a day was the amount that was reported to actually help in improving gastric motility. But again, it helps, but it doesn't solve the problem.
Well, and, you know, one of the things that was really a surprise to me in the recent past was finding out that there was a new medical journal called Neurogastroenterology and Motility.
Oh, now that's interesting.
neurogastro. So yes. You see, there's a recognition here that this has to do with our emotions as well. It has to do with our nervous system as well. You know, the stomach is really like the heart because it has a pacemaker. It paces electrical pulses in the stomach just like the heart does. And so just as we have the expressions in our language, oh, I felt like I was punched in the gut.
Right.
Boy, I really feel that in the pit of my stomach. You know, those are common sayings in our language.
Yes.
That really are truly reflecting what's going on as far as the belly is concerned with the immune system.
It's true. When you get stressed out, you'll increase corticotropin releasing factor, which increases corticotropin, which is the stimulus for the adrenals to put out your cortisol, the stress hormone, and adrenaline. And so when you increase your stress hormones, you're going to increase inflammation, increase stress on your gut, and yes, it's just like you got punched in the gut. You will actually derail your normal digestive process.
And so almost everybody's had the experience of, you know, maybe they have a fight, you know, with their spouse or their kids or at work or something, and then they eat right afterward and they feel like it sits in there like a shoe. They literally did not produce the digestive juices because they were so stressed out.
Exactly.
So when we begin to look at gastroparesis, essentially what I'm seeing coming from the gastroenterologists, at least here in Sarasota, is they're giving people a diet of nothing but pureed foods and pudding.
Yes.
Or these liquid things like Ensure and Boost, which, as you well know, I think the people that manufacture those things should be put in jail.
Yes.
Because I think they're some of the most dangerous things that are out there on the marketplace. Well,
they spent billions of dollars at this point making tasty food-like substances in cans that are really relatively toxic swill.
Well, tasty food-like substances, that's really good language, because what it is leftover byproducts of milk being used to make cheese.
Yes.
That's dried and then added to about four or five different sugars, artificial flavors, artificial colors, and then that's supposed
vitamins,
to be healthy.
A little bit
of vitamins. Right. You could cut out a picture of a bottle of vitamins.
Yes.
And pour the swill over it, and you'd get about as many vitamins that way. But what's true is that individuals can't take a lot of fiber. This is the point at which eating raw fruit and raw vegetables is really not the best idea.
And that's specifically, I believe, the raw fiber, the insoluble fiber, the roughage. Soluble fiber doesn't seem to cause as much of a problem, but it still can back things up.
And so individuals are often put on diets of pureed food like baby food or pudding-like things, yogurt-like things to eat as a way to, quote, treat gastroparesis. But what you're doing then is you're just narrowing people's food choices to what they can tolerate.
Right.
And so when we look at other choices, certainly juicing comes into the picture here. Whenever I've got somebody with gastroparesis, juicing is one of the things that I'm going to bring to the party.
Yeah, it's a great thing because what they've shown in studies is that the solid foods are really the first thing to have trouble getting through, and that would make sense because you have to actually manipulate that. Liquids tend to run downhill, and the stomach's set up so that gravity will drain it if you're standing up. So if you have a liquid diet, liquids are the last thing to become a problem with gastroparesis. They get through till the very end.
And so what I've recommended to people is that they juice, and I always recommend juicing with 50% greens and 50% sweet vegetables like carrots and beets. Parsnips and turnips, and the other 50% being things like parsley, spinach, kale, cabbage, celery. Remembering that with juicing, I'm always going to emphasize organic. You know, I emphasize organic anyway, but in juicing, it becomes imperative because you would not be able to eat the number of carrots that you could easily juice. So if you had pesticide residue on those foods, you're actually concentrating the pesticide residue in doing juicing.
Yeah, because you're taking so much more volume.
So you do juicing and then mix with that juice either whey protein. And again, I choose whey protein from New Zealand simply because the whey protein that's sold here in the United States is often contaminated with bovine growth hormone. Bovine growth hormone is given to cows, so the feds never tested it on humans. Because it's not given to humans, it's given to cows.
Right, it's kind of like the estrogen that comes from horses and a pill called Premarin that's given to humans and causes extra cancer. We don't really know what an alternative growth hormone given to humans is going to do to humans.
Exactly. And so I choose whey that comes from Canada or comes from New Zealand because they have regulations that don't allow the use of bovine growth hormones, other growth hormones, or antibiotics in that food. So we could take some of that clean whey protein, put it in that juice and make a smoothie out of it, or consider vegan choices of protein, like the combination of pea and rice that is my favorite of the vegan choices
like
of protein, and mix that in with the juice.
If you, I like one other thing added to that. It doesn't matter which, whether you use protein or the pea and rice protein, the whey protein or the pea and rice, and that is immune globulin. From also New Zealand organic cattle. Immune globulin is antibodies. It's an immune boost. And the reason I like to add it is because we know that small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, which is associated with gastroparesis, is associated with increased intestinal permeability and stress to the immune system. The immune globulins actually support your gut and help you shore up that permeability and stop it.
And so very many people know immune globulins in the products called colostrum. And so there are products that are superior to colostrum in terms of putting out immune globulins.
Very true.
So the nature of using a digestive enzyme before the meal, another gastric enzyme after the meal, rendering most meals into some variety of puree, whether that's eating cans of baby food or whether that's making juice and adding protein to it, those are ways that we can ease the gastroparesis. But then we want to look downstream. We want to look downstream in terms of the digestive tract of the small intestine and the large intestine and put in our favorite good guy bacteria, the probiotics.
Absolutely.
Remember, if that... It, despite the fact that it doesn't seem logical that if we had a liquid diet, we would still have a lot of fecal material, what's true is the body sheds off about a half a pound of cells virtually every single day in the digestive tract. And so there's still going to be bowel movements even if people are on a liquid diet.
Right.
And so putting in those good guy bacteria, and Dr. Harvey, I talk about good guy bacteria very frequently on the show, but
that
would you add something to that?
So good guy bacteria. Another reason that they're so good is that the strains that Eve and I tend to recommend for people have actually been isolated from humans. So what's unique about all living creatures is that we tend to talk to each other. The human strains of these probiotic bacteria tend to have little markers on the cell surfaces that actually can talk to humans better than other species.
So are you implying that there are probiotics that are sold out there in the marketplace that are not human species?
Absolutely. You know, in standard yogurt, if you don't actually inoculate it with human species, you're going to have cow species because the bacteria are basically coming off of the cow's udder if you're using raw milk product yogurt.
But well, that's an utter problem.
That's an utter problem because we're dealing with only pasteurized product here. And
remember,
so,
we're not paid. We get to do that because we're volunteers. You take a shot at a bad pun on a show like this, you've got to take that shot. That's all there is to it.
So, you know, the stuff that's out there, you can't get it from yogurt is what I'm saying. They don't put human bacteria in yogurt generally.
Sometimes they're plant bacteria, but sometimes
yes.
They're other animals.
Yes, and so they don't communicate well with us. So we need to actually get some that talk with us and tell our immune system to do the right job because that's what the bacteria do.
Yeah,
they help
it
work right.
I had an argument with a client, and I have to say it was an argument, with a client here just this last week who was trying to tell me that all probiotics were the same. And that there wasn't any difference. As
she
long
picked
as
the wrong argument with you.
Well, she was trying to say, well, these are good companies. You know, these are honorable companies. You know, they wouldn't be selling poor quality products. And I said, well, first off, if you look on the label, a whole lot of the labels of probiotics have the number of species, how many billion, how many million
right.
CFUs, colony-forming units that are in there. And then at the bottom of the label, it says at time of manufacture. meaning that's how many were in the pill at the time that it left the factory. That doesn't necessarily mean that that's how many are in the pill at the point you put it in your mouth.
Right.
Because you go in the back of a UPS truck in August in Sarasota that's 140 degrees. I don't know how those brown drivers do it, but, you know, when they come to my office to deliver packages, I'm astounded. And the nature of those hot trucks, if those probiotics are sitting in the back of a 140-degree truck and you're the last, your health food store is the last delivery on the route, then a certain number, not all of them, but a certain number of those bacteria have been killed off simply by being in that hot truck.
Yeah, they've just been cooked.
So, gastroparesis, not a pretty story, but a story that's becoming way too frequent, at least in my practice. And I think with the rise of diabetes in the United States happening as a result of everything from toxic pollutants to overeating to excess sugar in the American diet to genetic predisposition to obesity, I think we're going to be seeing a lot more gastroparesis, doctor. Do you agree?
I agree. For those reasons and for the fact that more doctors are aware of it, and they will test for it.
And so the nature of gastroparesis is you want to decide today. This ain't something you want.
That's for sure.
So if you're somebody that's on proton pump inhibitors, you know I've been warning you that the FDA themselves has come out and said that use of proton pump inhibitors for longer than 1 year increased the risk fracture of hip, spine, and wrist. So there is some really bad news on the other side of proton pump inhibitors. Yes, it might solve your heartburn, and then you won't have heartburn while you're laying in the bed with your broken hip.
What's really amazing is that there's only two actual indications for the proton pump inhibitors. 8 weeks of therapy for an ulcer and ongoing chronic therapy for somebody who has Zollinger-Ellison syndrome. A highly rare syndrome, maybe one in a million get it?
Or Barrett's esophagitis is the one that I see.
Right.
Almost everybody that gets diagnosed with Barrett's esophagitis is told they have to be on proton pump inhibitors for the rest of their lives.
You know what's interesting, though? I've not seen that as an indication in the PDR. This is an off-label use. I think the only actual indications are 8 weeks for ulcer and Zollinger-Ellison, and those people actually have a tumor or a type of overgrowth of acid-producing cells, and they just make too much acid permanently.
Well, we needed you to know this. We needed you to know this because we want you to take care of your digestion so that when I meet you at the WSLR social next Monday on the 22nd over at Goodfellows, I can walk up to you and say, hey, doctor, how's your middle burner?
My burner is doing just fine.
Our guest, Dr. Fred Harvey, internist and gerontologist in practice here in Sarasota for 15 years, and my buddy in holistic health. Thanks for being on the show, Dr. Harvey.
Thank you, Eve. Have a great week.
Oh, you do the same. I'll be on WMNF at 11 o'clock with Rob Lori on the Alternative Health Show, and I try to stay in the station for a few minutes after the show to take your calls and suggestions for future shows. You know, over and over again, the dilemma is, what do you talk about? Well, I want to remind you after last week's show about all that 36 million pounds of turkey being recalled, that this morning 60,000 pounds of hamburger meat and hot dog, hamburger meat and meatballs and meatloaf that were ready-made, some of which were sold in Winn-Dixie, has had a callback. So look in your refrigerator and see if you have any ground meat in there that you might have bought. It has an expire date of August the 12th. And remember what we say here on No Nonsense Nutrition, the riskiest thing that you can eat in a public place is ground meat.